You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with one of our regular Monocle contributors, Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute.
Plus, as finance ministers in Europe meet and more economic policy meetings get underway in Washington this week, we ask who's winning the battle of the economic models.
Plus, we sit down with the vice president of Nokia Design to discuss the future of communication.
We've led the way with wireless charging, essentially something we do every day, a repeated pattern. You just lay the phone on a charging pad, and now by embedding it even in other everyday objects, charging becomes part of the environment.
All of that, plus some great tracks from the Monocle playlist too. That's all in the next hour here on Midori House. Let's start off the next hour then with our headlines. Barney Burnham is here.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham.
Everyone started screaming and running towards us, and I was like, everyone's like a bomb, and me and him jumped over the railing and ran down there.
There were just families all around us with kids, I mean, yelling and screaming, and I mean, we just wanted to try and get away as quick as possible. But I mean, even being around the tall buildings, it's scary.
Yeah, it was loud. It was really, really loud, and then people, just chaos everywhere.
Eyewitnesses describing the moment when two bombs went off near the finishing line of Monday's Boston Marathon. President Obama has vowed to catch those responsible for the bombings, which killed three people and injured nearly 150 more. The president promised federal aid to the city and the state of Massachusetts. He also said he's directed the federal government to increase security around the United States as necessary after the explosions.
We still do not know who did this or why. And people shouldn't jump to conclusions before we have all the facts. But make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this. And we will find out who did this. We'll find out why they did this. Any responsible individuals, any responsible groups will feel the full weight of justice.
Officials say at least 17 people were critically injured, with a number of them losing limbs. Dr. Peter Fagenholz is a trauma surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
There's a lot of small metal debris. Some people have asked already about whether these were BBs or they were parts of bombs, and I just don't think we're able to say whether these are small bits of metal that were placed there intentionally or whether they were just part of the environment that were involved in the blast.
In other news, North Korea has issued new threats against South Korea. It's promising sledgehammer blows of retaliation if South Korea does not apologize for anti-North Korean protests held when the North was celebrating the birth of its founding leader Kim Il-sung on Monday. The North's KCNA news agency says North Korean army has issued an ultimatum to the South after rallies at which portraits of North Korea's leaders were burned. It also warned that there would be no warning of retaliatory action. President Obama and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have set up two rounds of talks in the coming months in a bid to move past a fight over human rights and to seek common ground on issues such as Iran, Syria and North Korea. The announcement of an Obama-Putin summit in early September adds to plans for a meeting at a G8 summit in Northern Ireland in June. The United States is pressing Russia to use its influence to help reduce tensions with North Korea. Washington and Moscow are also at odds over the civil war in Syria, and the two governments have also worked on the challenge posed by Iran's nuclear program. Venezuela's Electoral Commission has declared Nicolas Maduro the winner of the country's presidential election despite the opposition's demand for a recount. The official count gave him 50.7% of the votes, with his rival Enrique Capriles on 49.1%. Earlier, Mr. Capriles had declared the result illegitimate and called for national protests. Following the announcement, there were violent clashes in the capital Caracas, where police fired tear gas on hundreds of student demonstrators. Exxon says it's removed the damaged section of the Arkansas crude pipeline that leaked about 5,000 barrels of oil late last month. The company said the 52-foot section will be transported to an independent laboratory for metallurgy testing. It also said that the cleanup was almost complete in the affected section. The pipeline rupture on March the 29th said crude oil threw into the streets of a housing subdivision in Mayflower, a town of about 2,300 people north of Little Rock. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the world headlines. It is 8:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London, and we kickstart today's programme, as we do these days, by setting the day's agenda, where we quite simply look through some of the stories that will feature on our radar today here on Monocle 24.
And Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, joins us now in the studio with the three big stories we'll need to know for the coming 24 hours. Thanks for joining us here in the studio, Shashank. What's grabbed your attention today?
Well, there's three stories, all of which seem a little bit different, but they're united by one thing, which is the overarching competition in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And I think it's a really interesting theme that runs through nearly everything we look at in the news in the Middle East. The first story is the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, this collection of Gulf states, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, all of these countries, really looking at this earthquake that took place in Iran last week, a 6.3 magnitude earthquake, and getting really concerned about what would have happened if Iran's Bushehr nuclear reactor had been damaged. Because if you look at it, if it were to just, you know, be destroyed or harmed in any way, the radiation would spew right across Qatar, Bahrain, across the Gulf. And it's a fascinating story about the way in which, for the GCC, events within Iran on the coast, in the Gulf itself, in the Persian Gulf, might as well be domestic events, and why they're so worried about Iran's nuclear program, not just bombs, but also nuclear safety.
So are we perhaps seeing a slightly different turn that the Iran nuclear issue might take, in that the region itself, the very close neighbours to Iran, end up being more of a, putting more pressure on the nation than the outside forces that we've seen?
Close neighbours have always put reasonable pressure on Iran. They'll never go too far, because there are, of course, many small countries, and they're afraid of being bullied. They're afraid of being, you know, intimidated if they go too far. They always hide behind the bigger powers. They hide behind Saudi Arabia. They hide behind the United States. But they really, really are concerned. And, you know, they tend, when they pressure Iran, they tend to gang up. The GCC tends to be the vehicle by which they do it. But really, what it shows you is, even if the nuclear dispute is completely resolved and Iran says, OK, all right, hands up, here's all our documents, we did try and make nuclear weapons, we're not anymore, there is still this big issue, because Bushehr, which, by the way, is a Russian-built reactor on top of West German foundations, which makes it horribly rickety, horribly dangerous, isn't going to be covered by any nuclear agreement. So it's going to be a horrible issue that just sits there, not quite Chernobyl or something, but this is a real concern. Iranian engineering on nuclear sites is not famed for its structural integrity.
And that's why the GCC is pushing for the International Atomic Energy Agency to send in a specialized technical team to inspect the plant. At the moment, it looks like that's not necessarily going to happen anytime soon. What can we expect? Will Iran be opening its doors to officials from the IAEA, or will they simply say, you know, it's fine, leave us alone?
The IAEA can look at Bushehr, but not in as much depth as the GCC or indeed anyone else wants. Iran is one of the only countries in the world, I think perhaps the only country, operating a nuclear reactor that has not signed a key convention for the safety of these things. That's a really worrying thought. Now, will it sign it? Maybe at some point in the future. But under this government, Iran domestically is under so much turmoil. You know, elections coming up in June, of course. I don't see any big steps being taken. But if this earthquake had been slightly, you know, slightly to a different place, it could have been absolutely catastrophic.
Let's talk about another story that you have pulled for us that you think is an agenda setter today, and that is, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the fact that the IMF were heading to Egypt for more talks, haven't necessarily gone as everyone might have hoped.
No, and again, first of all, people might be wondering, what's this got to do with Saudi Arabia and Iran? What's this got to do with the region? It's Egypt. It's far to the west of the Gulf, big country, but really in a different part of the Middle East. And the answer is... Egypt really needs cash, right? It's running out of money. The IMF isn't giving it this loan. There have been inconclusive talks. What's really fascinating is, and what's not mentioned in many of these articles, is last week Qatar gave Egypt, I think, $2 to $3 billion. I need to look up the exact amount, but billions of dollars, having said, we won't give you any more money until you agree with the IMF. Not at all, not a penny. Okay, all right, here's $2 billion. And it's because they are petrified of Egypt going under. And then Libya did the same. Libya gave them $2 or $3 billion as well. Libya, you know, a new post-revolutionary country paying its own revolutionary militia still in complete chaos, paying Egypt, this big grandfather of the Middle East, cash to stay afloat. And part of this is a real concern that Egypt stays within the Sunni-dominated bloc, stays under Saudi Arabia's wing. Under Hosni Mubarak, Egypt was always a reliable anti-Iranian ally. A bulwark of the Sunni Middle East. And now the concern is, if it goes completely under, where is it headed? Will this country just collapse? So these IMF talks may seem very arcane, very technocratic, but if Egypt does not get this money, we are talking about chaos on the streets of Cairo, policemen going home, the Suez Canal suffering from instability. This is a big story.
What sapped Egypt of all of their cash?
Horrible economic mismanagement by a corrupt, feckless military junta that ruled in the immediate aftermath of Mubarak, years of mismanagement under Mubarak himself, and most recently, of course, a government dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood that is utterly unwilling to compromise with its political opponents, that is, sees democracy as a way of amassing as much power for itself as it can, and simply hasn't made any effort to reform Egypt's bloated program of handouts, subsidies, and cronyism. So until they fix that, it will keep hemorrhaging money.
Well, this is the balance that they have to strike, isn't it? The difficulty of trying to reduce those subsidies while avoiding any sort of political unrest
and
reaction.
And, this comes at a very, very sensitive time, because if you go to the Suez Canal, look at the cities along there, Port Said and others, Alexandria. Port Said has been in a state of virtual revolution for 2 months. The police don't have a grip on it. There's an uprising there. People are attacking Muslim Brotherhood offices. You know, Egypt today is ungovernable, which is why, by the way, there won't be a coup, because the army doesn't want to take charge of this mess.
Well, these IMF talks aren't... they're not finished. They're not over. They're just simply stalled. Does it look likely that there will be some agreement for this $4.8 billion loan?
This is really this is the $5 billion question. No one honestly knows. I mean, the consequences of not reaching this agreement are too horrible for anyone to contemplate. Egypt is too big to fail. Right?
So your prediction is that
they will eventually find a deal after many injections of emergency cash by countries like Qatar and Libya. But, you know, for the IMF, they do not want to be played by Egypt. Egypt is currently blackmailing them, and the IMF does not like it.
Let's move on to the third prong of your Saudi Arabia and Iran stories today. This is Yemen.
Yes, Yemen again, once more, North Africa, quite far away from the Gulf. But this is the FT has done some great coverage this week, and a lot of other people have covered what's happening in Yemen, which is we're really seeing the country turn into a sort of cockpit for great power struggles. You have, of course, Saudi Arabia, which neighbours Yemen to the north, has a long history of influence with the tribes in Yemen's north. You have Iran, which is getting in on the game. It sees Yemen as a soft underbelly of the Arabian Peninsula, the way you can reach and hit Saudi Arabia when you can't go anywhere else. They are allegedly sending weapons and other forms of assistance to northern Houthi tribesmen, rebellious tribesmen, and secessionist groups in the south. And all of this is going on while the supposed government that was formed after the fall of Ali Abdullah Saleh, the last president, is supposed to hold elections by February next year. It's very difficult to see how he does that. give you one example, the country's Scud missiles are controlled by the Republican Guard, which is controlled by Abdullah Saleh's son. The defense ministry says, can we have the Scud missiles back, please? He said, no, I think I'll keep them. So it gives you a sense of, you know, how incredibly fragmented this country is, with all these outside powers, which includes, by the way, the United States and us and others, poking in there trying to secure their own interests.
And the nation's state-run media announced a few days ago that Yemen's president removed Ali Abdullah Saleh's son and his nephews from those powerful security posts last week. Is that a sign, do you think, Shawshank, that things are maybe slowly starting to move in the right direction?
I'd like to think so, but it depends greatly on how the elections next year go. It's easy to see the elections being disrupted and people simply reverting to these old alliances. I mean, yes, his sons have been removed, but are the units he commanded still loyal to the new state, to the new government, to an elected government that succeeds them? Or are they still taking orders from Saleh secretly? The problem is, you know, Mubarak went into this military prison. He fell. He was exiled. Ben Ali from Tunisia went to Saudi Arabia. These people, Gaddafi was killed. Ali Abdullah Saleh is still sitting there. His sons are still sitting there. They're in the country. And don't underestimate what an impact that has on the way these power struggles can play out if you still have the old king sitting there looking at everyone behind the scenes.
And it should be pointed out, of course, quite how, I guess, unique Yemen is in the region. It's the poorest country in the region, isn't it? It's a country that in future is expected to have a major problem with having any water of its own.
Poor,
as well.
Absolutely. Poor, as you point out, has grave ecological problems that foreshadow many of the problems Gulf regimes will face: a lack of water, a lack of farmland, catastrophic management. They don't have these deep oil reserves to bail them out like everyone else does.
Shawshank Joshi, a research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, many thanks for bringing us up to speed.
Coming up with the European Finance Ministers' meetings ongoing and the US economic policy gatherings in Washington kickstarting on Thursday, we'll compare and contrast the different economic visions on either sides of the pond.
Years of scouring the globe for the world's best baristas means Monocle knows what makes a good cafe, which is why we're making a great one, just a stone's throw away from our London headquarters. Tucked away between neighbourhood shops on Chiltern Street and Marylebone, pop in to the Monocle Cafe for freshly baked pastries, simple delicious lunches, or a delectable dessert, all served alongside artfully made coffee, naturally. Have your cake and eat it, in or out, at London's new Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dana.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monocle, in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House Live from Studio One with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time is 8:18 in 10:18 in Istanbul. It is 8:18 here in London and 1:18 in Washington, D.C. The global economy is dividing into a three-speed system with Europe stuck in the lowest gear. That's the way IMF boss Christine Lagarde sees things, at least. EU officials, on the other hand, believe the euro area has made further progress in the implementation of its comprehensive crisis response strategy. So says a leaked statement ahead of the finance minister's meeting later this week.
Indeed, the gap between those two points of view increasingly represents a gulf in economic thinking between the EU and basically everywhere else, the US certainly. And the US particularly would back a growth offensive. So just how wide is that gulf between the strategies of the states and of Europe? Well, David McWilliams is an author on economic matters. He joins us on the line from Ireland now. David, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for joining us. Perhaps you could start start by giving us an economics 101 on this issue. Run through the basics of exactly how the US and Europe are approaching things differently at present, then we'll delve a little deeper.
Well, the basics are very straightforward. The Americans are doing what Americans always do, which is really have a pragmatic solution now and worry about the details and the consequences later. So it's always a growth-first agenda in America. The Europeans, on the other hand, are getting themselves tied up in, and as speaker, as an Irish citizen of the EU and the Eurozone, so we're involved in it too, are getting themselves tied up in legal wranglings, in philosophical discussions about the nature of the economy, but ultimately the Europeans are allowing the economies of Europe to suffer now in order to prove a point to somebody else later, but that somebody else hasn't really been identified. So what you're getting is a dramatic increase of unemployment in the European Union at a time when interest rates have fallen dramatically. And in the United States, you're having an increase in unemployment, but that has been combated by a very aggressive economic policy by both the Fed and the Obama administration to try and kickstart the economy. So you have kind of malignant neglect, I would argue, in Europe, whereas you have benign opportunism in America. And this has been seen quite clearly in the data, because the American economy, although it's not necessarily robust and muscular, as one would expect after a long recession, it is recovering. And the reason it isn't robust and muscular is both economies are blighted by, and this is a key, what's called deleveraging in economics, which is how do we pay back all the money we borrowed in the boom? In the case of America, it was American households borrowing money largely to buy houses and to go on a consumer binge between 2000 odd and let's say 2008. And in the case of Europe, it was rather different. But you had consumer binges in certain areas, Ireland and Spain, and then you had governments going on spending binges in the cases of Italy, Greece. And ultimately, what you also have in the mix, and this is really crucial, is that you have ethnic differences. So in Northern Europe, you have creditor countries that are getting, frankly, fed up of bailouts. And in Southern countries, in Southern Europe, you have debtor countries that are getting fed up of austerity. All that means that both the two largest economies in the world, and people always talk about China, but they forget that the European Union together and America are still by far and away the largest economies in the world. They are moving in opposite directions.
But then we can certainly argue then that the American model or the way that they've approached the situation is working. Housing prices is on the rise. There are more new home constructions. Consumer confidence is on the rise. Unemployment back below 8%. They're seeing growth of GDP around 3% this quarter. Compare that with Eurozone growth under negative 0.4%. So certainly you could argue then that it is the American model that is the way to go forward.
You're in no doubt. I mean, nobody disagrees. What perplexes Europeans is why the European Union is sticking to an economic policy that economic history tells us does not work. And this is a very simple thing. You cannot have austerity and government cutbacks at a time when you have a liquidity trap, which means your people have too much debt and they don't want to borrow, and your banks have too much bad debt and they don't want to lend. You cannot have a policy like that and expect anything other than high levels of unemployment. The United States, on the other hand, as you say, have said, okay, hold on a second. We're going to throw the kitchen sink at this. We are going to expand dramatically QE, which is basically the central bank, making money available to the banks to lend if they want to do so. And we're going to expand dramatically the budget deficit because we believe, as you said, that we need to kickstart the economy right now. So the Americans are very clearly, in my view, turning the corner. As you said, a huge slew of data. Now, it's not always great. Last week's non-farm payrolls weren't the best in terms of American unemployment. But there's a huge slew of data to say there is life in the American consumer. And as you said, the GDP growth in the States is going to be moving ahead quite nicely in the next quarter. In contrast, in Europe is marked. I mean, basically what you had is Germany had a plan. Okay, and that plan was that we would all turn into little Germans once we adopted the euro. But, you know, I'd like to quote that great American economist now, Mike Tyson, who said that everybody has a plan until they get a punch in the face. And the punch in the face the Germans got was that we didn't turn into Germans. In actual fact, the Irish became flamboyantly more Irish, the Greeks delinquently more Greek, the Spanish colorfully more Spanish. And now Germany is a problem, which is what? we did this. We became outsized versions of ourselves using borrowed German money. And when Germany came to look for the money back, it wasn't there. So what you have is a breakdown of trust at the center of the European Union. The Germans feel that they gave money to the periphery in good faith and we couldn't pay it back. We feel that they overlent to us at a time recklessly and we now can't pay it back. And nobody has the moral authority or the economic authority to cut the deal which will allow the periphery. And I'm not talking about small countries. I'm talking about Italy. I'm talking about Spain. These are large countries. Allow these countries to grow. And that really is the dilemma. Whereas in the United States, as you guys know, at least you have a single political institution. You have a single president. You have a buy-in to America on the part of all Americans. And these are very important factors when you're trying to get a deal. Our problem in Europe is we have one man, one vote democracy, always overshadowed by one man, one flag nationalism. And when you get both of those together, what you tend to get is a step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. And ultimately, who pays? It's the poor, the 20 million, or any of the 20 million who are now unemployed in the European Union, in the Eurozone. These are the guys who are playing.
David, can we briefly talk about timescales? I mean, the sort of urgency of getting a reaction from the US is clearly driving their policy all along. The EU going for proving a point, as you said, to someone at some point in the future. How far in the future? What sort of timescales are we talking? We've had figures saying that things are looking fairly encouraging for 2013, but how long before we can reasonably expect to see some sort of point proven?
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting point because any trained economist will tell you that there is no evidence in history that the policy the EU is now operating and enforcing through a fiscal compact. Don't forget that the European electorates voted on a fiscal compact which outlaws government spending in the next couple of years over and above a certain threshold. So this is the sort of economics of naughty land. Nobody's really ever got their head around this. Okay? So you ask the question, how long? Well, this could go on for a long, long time. Why? Because people in the European Union are terrified and they are saving. And as the savings ratio rises, spending falls. But if you take the view, and it's the very simple view in economics, that your spending is actually my income, if you stop spending, then my income falls. And if my income falls, my spending falls. And it's very easy to get into a downward spiral unless the governments come in with a new growth strategy along the lines of what Mr. Obama has put in the States. Now, how long depends on where you sit. If you sit in Germany and you're a creditor country and your economy is moving nicely, your unemployment is 7%, you have elections, you certainly don't want Mrs. Merkel to rock the boat, you can say this can go on indefinitely.
David, we're
if
just,
you're sitting in David, Italy or Spain or Greece, it's a totally different
David,
scenario.
Sorry to interrupt. We're just running out of a bit of time, but I just want to thank you very much for coming on Midori House. That was David McWilliams in Dublin, economist and author of Follow the Money There.
And we'll be back in Cairo in a second. The time is 9:28 in Cairo, which is where we're heading now for a roundup of the headlines on the ground.
Abdel Rahman Hussein is our man there, and he's on the line. Welcome to the show, Abdel. Let's get straight into the first story. There's a new report of a fact-finding committee created by President Morsi, and some parts of this report have been leaked to the press.
Yes, it's very interesting. The report was finished about 3 months ago, and nothing's been heard of it. And it's starting to leak to the press. And the leaks entail the military responsible for killings, torture, and abductions of protesters from the onset of the January 25th, 2011 uprising and onwards. And as the report was leaked, Morsi is quick to speak out against it, placing a stall firmly with the army, claiming that it's innocent of such charges.
And at the same time, Hosni Mubarak has been released pending a retrial.
Sort of. I mean, the judge ordered his release because he's been in provisional detention over these charges for 2 years. However, he will remain behind bars because of corruption charges pending against him in another case.
And do we know when that trial will recommence?
The judge has recused himself, citing a conflict of interest. So they're waiting on picking out another judge to take over the case. So we're not really sure.
How much public interest is there about Mubarak's Mubarak's journey since then, and how much attention is there on his sort of the legal wranglings around what will happen to him?
It's interesting. It's turned into somewhat of a sideshow. I mean, on the one hand, some people say, or some people believe, or are reading that Mubarak no longer matters and his fate no longer is of relevance to the future of the country. Others see it as symptomatic of where this revolution is headed, especially under the Muslim Brotherhood rule and the inability to sort of achieve any sort of goals for the revolution, including bringing justice to the perpetrators.
And Abdel, you have a fascinating story here regarding a harassment case against the information minister.
At the press conference, he was asked by a female journalist. She was asking him, where was freedom of expression in Egypt with so many journalists being placed on trial and persecuted by the regime of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood? And he is affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. And his response was, and I quote, come here and I'll show you, while he was smiling. This isn't the first time an incident like this has happened with the information minister. There's been another incident also with he was being interviewed by a female reporter, and he said something that was construed as somewhat sexist. And at the time, it was attributed to a sort of slip of the tongue, but this happening again, the man has previous, and I mean, aside from the terribly disgusting, there's no other way to put it, response and the manner. So the journalist is filing a case of harassment against them.
Any sign that the information minister's job could be in question?
It depends on how far the case goes, but I mean, he is, along with many other ministers in the cabinet, under the spotlight for things that are not too, not too positive.
Okay, Abdel, thanks very much indeed, as ever, for joining us. Abdel Rahman Hussein there.
And in the next half hour of the program, our own young Turk, Alexandra de Kramer, will take us through the Turkish press. And looking ahead to this week's Section D, we sit down with Nokia's head of design and discuss the future of communication, no less.
We're going to see layers into everyday life of more devices and products that are dedicated. They're smaller, closer to the skin on us, in us, with us. That will do one or two things really well, and these will have mechanical interfaces.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Thanks, Phil. President Obama has vowed to catch those responsible for the bombings which killed three people and injured nearly 150 more near the finishing line of the Boston Marathon. The president has promised federal aid to the city and the state of Massachusetts. He also said he's directed the federal government to increase security around the United States as necessary after the explosions. North Korea has issued new threats against South Korea. It's promising sledgehammer blows of retaliation if South Korea does not apologise for anti-North Korean protests held when the North was celebrating the birth of its founding leader Kim Il-sung on Monday. President Obama and the Russian President Vladimir Putin have set up two rounds of talks in the coming months in a bid to move past a fight over human rights and seek common ground on issues such as Iran, Syria and North Korea. They'll be holding a summit in early September. Before that, they plan to meet at a G8 summit in June. Venezuela's Electoral Commission has declared Nicolas Maduro the winner of the country's presidential election, despite the opposition's demand for a recount. The official count gave him 50.7% of the votes, with his rival Enrique Capriles on 49.1%. Exxon says it's removed the damaged section of the Arkansas crude pipeline that leaked about 5,000 barrels of oil late last month. The company said the 52-foot section will be transported to an independent laboratory for metallurgy testing. It also said that cleanup was almost complete in the affected section. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in just about 27 minutes with another check of the world news at 9 o'clock London time. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, bringing people together from different sectors of the industry and different parts of the globe is without a doubt Salone de Mobile's greatest trump card. If you talk to visitors at the 52nd Annual Design Furniture Festival in Milan this year, and they'll tell you they've taken different approaches to doing the Salone. Instead of ticking off the major brands and zooming around the fair, clocking up sofa trends and late-breaking table shapes, they've attended panel talks, discussions, and debates and used the time in between to set up meetings.
Salone de Mobile is not just about furniture. It's a good litmus test for the future of the way we might live, too. And last week, one such event took place, joint-hosted by Finnish brands Liitelaar and Nokia. Over breakfast, a select gathering got down to discussing the future of communication in everyday life. No easy task. Well, our design editor Hugo McDonald is up to said task. Of course, he sat down with Marco Ashitari, Nokia's Vice President of Design, to find out more.
We got together, Harri Koskinen, who's a close friend, creative director at Iittala, and I, what we did was, first of all, we were showcasing our latest Nokia Lumia products alongside beautiful Iittala, kind of in swaths of color. But one thing we did was we showed a prototype. One thing Alvar Aalto said is never forget to play. So we played a little bit at the workshop in Helsinki, and what Harri and Iittala did is they took the Sarjaton tray and we embedded wireless charging in it. One of the things I think everybody that you've seen here is struggling with is how to keep your smartphones charged at Salone.
Tell me about
and, it. And what we've done is we've led the way with wireless charging, essentially something we do every day, a repeated pattern. You just lay the phone on a charging pad, and now by embedding it even in other everyday objects, charging becomes part of the environment. So we take interactions that normally would require much more effort and attention, cables, planning, now becomes something very just serendipitous. You lay it down and charge it. And I think this is one trend, is that these things that you do every day will just become embedded into the environment. They'll be more glanceable in terms of the user interface, is not requiring so much effort and attention. And it was well received.
I'm sure it was. It sounds very practical and very Finnish as well, and that's a seamless embedding design into life, which was, of course, the major push behind Helsinki World Design Capital last year as well. And I know you were very much involved in that, as was everybody, impressively, not just in Helsinki, but so many Finns. Has it been a success? It's interesting to have you here now to be able to say, you know, 1 year after Helsinki was the World Design Capital, was there benefits to it that will live longer than that year?
It's interesting you raise it in this context, because there were quite a few applications of design thinking beyond the design area. And I think that's where you'll see the longer term effects. I don't see it so much in the areas of traditional design or communication or awareness of design. One of the projects I liked the most was actually called Redesigning 925. I don't know if you heard about it. We weren't involved in it particularly, but they worked with 10 companies, a small studio. Essentially, with the, they gave themselves the brief, how do you redesign knowledge work and office work? So what would be a better work week? And one of the things they come up with, which I really like, is 4-3-2-1. So every day, and this is Hugo for you, every day, do 4 hours of good work. Good work is meaningful work on those things that are most important to you. That doesn't mean you don't, you only work 4 hours, but 4 hours of good work. Three goals a week. Two can be professional, one personal, if you make that distinction. And you use that as a filter for the 4 hours. Two steps to clear your mind. As that incoming stuff comes in, get it out of your short-term memory and cognition. Put it on a list or in your phone, wherever, and then have pauses and spaces during the day where you go through those lists. So get your mind clear so you can think creatively. And one, every day, give yourself license to think about one big creative question that you need to solve. And therefore, when you have any break, you're grabbing a coffee or walking to your next meeting, you allow yourselves to think about it. So 4-3-2-1. So that was one enduring legacy.
You make it sound so easy, Marco. Are you abiding by the 4-3-2-1 program yourself?
I think everyone that deals with intense knowledge work and competitive, you have some systems like that. I just like the way they summarized it. 4-3-2, I've been doing most of my life in some form. One I find interesting because it allows you to focus and give yourself license to think creatively about one thing. That usually gets your subconscious going. So I notice having applied that, you're swimming in the morning, which I do a kilometer every day, and suddenly you just notice that, that's what might be a path forward. So,
well done you. I'm going to try and master that myself. It's interesting, though, because many of the points that you've just brought up there are things that I've been hearing and seeing from many of the guests that we've had on the radio while we've been here at Milan. And this whole seems to be a very clear divide between either incorporating technology into your way of life in a way that actually declutters it somehow, or returning to something that is very craft-based and tactile and sort of in many ways completely eschewing technology and mastering skills that connect people to nature all over again. I mean, these two tenets are really at the heart of Finnish design as well, and something that you yourself have really tried to incorporate into Nokia. How's that going?
If we look at the identity of our new Nokia Lumia product, so there's a certain purity there, taking away everything unnecessary, but you're still left with something that has warmth to it, that has a humanness. And in the studio, we actually talk about very seriously and that technology should make us more human. And if you really take that seriously, that's a very tall order. So we were talking a little bit earlier about glanceable user interfaces or interfaces that don't require more attention. You walk even here in, let's say, this wonderful tea room here, you'll see couples pinching and zooming with their heads down. We have the goal to design for people to have their head up again. What does that mean? It means better glanceable user interfaces, more mechanical user interfaces to the digital. So I think the interesting thing about the technology industry, it has huge waves. And these waves are typically, there are a few companies controlling a certain way, but we're going to see layers into everyday life of more devices and products that are dedicated. They're smaller, closer to the skin on us, in us, with us, that will do one or two things really well, and these will have mechanical interfaces. So I think that trend is important. The other one is personalization. You said it. How does it go into structure? With my Nokia Lumia, if you even take a look at the screen here, it's all full of people. And these are the people I communicate with most. And it's all centered around the people, places, and actions I do every day, not apps. So it's not screens of apps where you have to, which one was that one I needed to check, but rather it disintegrates into the actions that you want to do and personalizing that.
Marco Artisari, Vice President of Design for Nokia there, and I'm told part-time opera singer. Might be able to get some more info on that in a second. No less speaking to Hugo McDonald there. I, for one, have had enough of Hugo McDonald. What do you think, Phil?
You can never have too much of Hugo McDonald.
Okay.
And I'm very lucky to say that we do have our design editor, Hugo McDonald, in the studio with us, fresh from his trip over to Milan with our producer, Alad John, as well, from Salone de Mobile. Hugo, thanks very much for coming this early Tuesday morning.
It's a pleasure. I've had enough of Hugo McDonald, too. Sorry, everybody.
So you've come back from Salone. What was your... what was your initial reaction from it?
Well, word on the street was, and actually you could see and visibly feel that it was a much quieter Salone than it has been in previous years. Milan and the Italian furniture industry has done a very good job of putting a brave face on their own economic plight. They, in previous years, said, no, we haven't been touched. Actually, our markets are completely safe because we deal at the very high end. We still have plenty of orders, both on home soil and abroad. But this year, it was definitely noticeably quieter. Not helped by the weather. It poured with rain and was freezing. And everybody kept indoors. So Milan felt eerily quiet, where in previous years, the excitement and buzz of Salone is something that doesn't just take place at the fairgrounds, but takes over the whole city in a sort of carnival atmosphere with a lot of furniture.
So, what a descriptor. So even the titans of PR were unable to make the economic climate invisible around it.
Absolutely. And in many ways, I mean, that makes it sound a bit depressing, but it was quite refreshing to suddenly have these big Italian furniture giants be a bit more honest and say things are difficult, things are tough. We haven't spent anything like the amount that we would have done in previous years just because we don't have it. And they're beginning to understand the importance of exports as being the key to keeping their companies alive, whereas previously they've relied so much on their domestic markets, they realise that market just doesn't really exist anymore. One man who has a heritage furniture business said that he was struggling to raise his exports above 35%, which at the moment he said is not enough to keep his company going. If he can't get it to more like 60% within the next year, then he said that he probably wouldn't be showing at the fair next year, which is quite a serious turning point for the Italian furniture industry. But like I say, the fact that they're now being honest means that there's sort of hope, and also they're working together. This is the big thing. Whereas previously they were very sort of Italian and proud and didn't really like the idea. Everything was very secretive. They didn't want to share necessarily their technological advances or the R&D that they were investing in with their neighbours who they saw as competitors. Now you see a lot of them actually coming together, opening joint showrooms, moving into markets together. So these are all good developments. It might have been a leaner Salone, but I think it was better for it.
I just want to touch on that point because I remember speaking to you last week and you said how a lot of the smaller, more independent brands, they were joining forces and they were kind of renting showrooms themselves or workshops and, you know, kind of really joining forces. Did you find then that on the other end of the scale that Salone was great this year for the smaller independent designers because it really gave them a chance to show their stuff?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the one big thing actually also at Salone this year that struck me is the fact that on the one hand, you have the furniture, which it can be quite difficult if you're not there to see beyond all the chairs and sofas that you see printed in numerous press and newspapers and things. But actually the discussion and the talks and the debates and the, I mean, we heard there Marco Artesari from Nokia, who hosted a fantastic discussion about the future of communication and technology in everyday life. This is actually what Salone is more interesting for to me nowadays, is the talks about what the industry will look like in the future.
So it's no longer about the chair or...
It's no longer really about just walking around and looking at new chairs. And in many ways this year, it was a real kind of meeting point where suddenly all the furniture in the showroom seemed just a little bit redundant because they don't really work. They're not working at the moment, that traditional method of a sort of manufacturer, producer, retailer. It's the talks that are happening in the empty spaces next door where they say, well, you know, how are we going to produce furniture in the future? How are we going to get it to market? And how are we going to make money from this industry?
You spent a week there pretty much with our producer, Alad. He came back with a faraway look in his eye after
missing a flight.
Oh, ouch. Let's not talk about that one.
In his defense, it was an early flight.
Yeah, it was a very early flight.
Probably shouldn't talk too much about Alad's alarm clock on the show. But what else? Tell us about some other colourful characters you may or may not have met during your week with Alad.
Well, I can promote Section D at this point, the weekly design hour, which will air for the first time tonight at 1900 hours, which will give you a very nice roundup of some of the amazing people that we met. We spoke to a wide range, a cross-section of people from all around the world, from different kind of corners of the industry. And really the theme that came out of Salone this year was, and it's quite a big theme, but technology, and how that really is impacting not just the way people are designing furniture, the way furniture is being produced, but also the way people, young independent designers, who mentioned there, Phil, are making their own furniture. They're not relying on manufacturers to have their designs put into production. They're actually designing the machines themselves to produce the furniture. And then they're going online and developing a website so that they can get that furniture into people's hands quicker. So this whole established model of the industry is kind of being turned on its head.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Hugo, for coming into the studio this morning. You'll have to run down to the Monocle Cafe and have a croissant and a coffee to start your day. But thanks very much for coming on. Section D is on this evening at 1900 London time, so be sure to tune into that.
We'll be looking at the Turkish front pages in just a moment, but David Bowie first. This is Fashion. David Bowie there with Fashion.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds, and the ever fashionable Alexandra Kramer is in studio with us, joining us to have a ruffle through this morning's Turkish front pages. Good morning, Alex.
Hello, good morning.
You were connecting that back to the David Bowie song. You weren't just being sycophantic to
well,
Alexandra.
I think she's
because
very
she's
fashionable.
Here. No, she certainly is, but it's a bit weird if it, the song hadn't preceded it. But
it's just a compliment. I'm allowed
so we're
to do
okay.
compliments.
Yes, good.
Moving on quickly. Alex, you have something that's caught your attention from the Milliyet newspaper.
Yes. So the big news is that the trial of Fazıl Say just ended yesterday. Fazıl Say is this world-renowned Turkish pianist. He lives in Vienna for 5 years now, but he keeps on coming and going. And he had tweeted apparently insulting comments on religious beliefs. And yesterday the trial ended after a three-year period. And he has been... He has got a 10-month jail sentence.
Okay, and so these messages he sent out mm-hmm. on a social network, give us an idea of the sort of thing they were.
So basically, they were general comments about like that he doesn't believe in God. Some poems, one poem from Omar Hayyam, who's considered like this religious poem for a poet from the 16th century, saying, I have it actually in front of me, the English translation. So he tweeted something that says, "You say its rivers will flow in wine. Is the Garden of Eden a drinking house? You say you will give 2 hours to each Muslim. Is the Garden of Eden a whorehouse?" Which this is considered an insult to religion.
Yes.
And because it says it in our constitute, you can actually be trialed for it.
But Fazıl, he lives in Vienna.
Yeah.
So is it likely that he will spend 10 months in prison?
I don't know yet, because also another thing was that they said he's autistic. The judge said he's autistic, so he can be forgiven for his deeds, for what he has done. Likely he won't come back to Turkey and just not do the jail sentence, which I would recommend.
If the judge is listening. I mean, we've seen in lots of countries recently the coming together of social networks and laws about defamation and libel and saying things that people shouldn't. Is this sort of moving that debate on in Turkey about what people should and shouldn't say online?
True. Yeah, of course it is. I think there are two interesting points. One, because internet law is non-existent and nowhere in the world, as you said. So it's kind of putting laws and regulations for that. But I think what's interesting as well is that it's again a portrayal that we don't have freedom of speech in Turkey. Because the sentence I read to you, it has nothing... It attempts to call Garden of Eden a whorehouse, but it's a play on words and it's not necessarily means what it actually is. So it's again proving that we can't say what we want in Turkey.
And Alex, moving on to the Habertürk newspaper, I'm just looking at the front page here. They have some pretty strong images, of course, from the explosions in Boston yesterday evening from the marathon. But you've got a story regarding the opening of the Kutlu Dogum week.
So next to the marathon picture, there you can see three guys. So the first one that's wearing a kind of like a white dress and a hat. He's our president of religion. So they all visited the president of religion and two other ministers visited Diyarbakır. It's a special religious holiday. And Diyarbakır is like the most populated Kurdish city in Turkey. And what is happening is he greeted the Kurds in Turkey in Kurdish, and which was a big deal. And part of this peace process, obviously, the Kurdish-Turkish peace process, it's ongoing, and give a speech, because in 2014, the airport in Diyarbakır, it's going to be an international airport, and they're trying to kind of promote the region, being like, we are investing, and this government is attempting to reach out to its people, because that was the biggest problem that the Kurds said, there's not enough investment, there's not enough governmental presence here, and no one really cares or thinks about us. So it's a nice step for them.
So are we seeing alongside the sort of political wranglings and we've covered a lot what's been going on with the PKK, of course, are we seeing a lot of these sorts of public sort of displays, these sort of photo opportunities to kind of tell that story to the masses and get it on the front of newspapers.
Exactly. I think that's what's happening. And especially like for these kind of religious holidays, which I'm sure Kutlu Doğum Week, I'm not even sure what exactly it is. I don't think it's like a huge mark in the Muslim calendar. It's just a small little holiday. So, yeah, obviously, yeah.
And moving on to the Radikal newspaper, building from our theme on the PKK, the jailed PKK leader, Öcalan, he's prioritizing the withdrawal of militants from Turkey. Obviously, a very good sign, I guess, in terms of the country moving forward towards peace.
Yeah, they have set a date by the end of summer. Obviously, all the militants were supposed to leave the country. Now he's going to hold four different conferences around Turkey to kind of encourage that and speed up the trial and the evacuation of militants in Turkey. And in Radikal, they have this huge interview with one of the representatives who lives in Brussels. His name, Remzi Kartal, who one-on-one went to Imrala, the island, the prison island where Abdullah Öcalan stayed, and talked to him about how they're going to move forward with this peace plan.
Do we have any idea what will happen to the imprisoned man himself should peace come?
I don't know. That's the most interesting part, because he's been in prison for 3 decades now. And they're not. I don't believe it would be a huge reaction from Turkish people if they actually let him go. So I don't know. I don't think he'd be pardoned, but I don't know what they have offered him or what's going to happen.
Alexandra, thank you. It certainly is. Thank you very much for your insights this morning. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, our crack producer, Aled John, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager, Sam Impey. Up after the news is the latest edition of The Entrepreneurs, courtesy of Sophie Grove. And Andrew Tuck and Phil will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.